action. Eisner maintains that he began with a dramatic gesture, offering to resign. "If you think this will go away, I'm happy to get off the stage," he said. There was a chorus of protests. Eisner couldn't leave because no one else could do the job, and it would leave Disney more vulnerable to the Comcast offer. A majority on the board felt that it had to find a way to both keep Eisner and placate what was clearly an angry group of shareholders. 10 days earlier, takeover defense lawyer Martin Lipton had suggested splitting the positions of chairman and chief executive, as many shareholder advocates and both Gold and Roy had long recommended. The board had resisted. But now Lipton argued forcefully that the board had to do something to show it was responding to shareholders. To ignore the massive vote of protest might play into Comcast's strategy of portraying the directors as advocates of management rather than shareholders. Eisner hated the idea that he was giving in to shareholder pressure, or that he was being stripped of his title, but in principle, he said he didn't mind ceding the title of chairman as long as he remained CEO with his authority undiminished. But that meant the chairman had to be someone he'd be comfortable with. Ironically, separating the titles of chairman and chief executive gave Eisner enormous leverage over the board. Under his contract, drafted by Irwin Russell, Eisner's lawyer and until recently a board member, relieving Eisner of either the chairman or chief executive title constituted a breach of his contract, giving Eisner the right to leave within 30 days with all the benefits specified in his contract, which would cost Disney millions. Indeed, Russell was on hand to underscore this very point. Thus, if Eisner were relieved of his title on terms he didn't like, he could leave at once and force Disney to pay him an enormous sum. Eisner's choice to succeed him as chairman was George Mitchell. He felt he was the only person on the board with the stature to quell public criticism, and he was someone who, over time, Eisner had come to trust, at least up to a point, notwithstanding the awkward matter of the Comcast negotiations. In the eyes of at least a few of the directors, however, Eisner's motives were more transparent. Eisner felt he could control him. Hours had already elapsed, and now Mitchell expressed doubts about taking the job. He pointed out that he didn't really know the industry and lacked experience as a businessman. He also didn't want to spend more time in California, away from his home on the East Coast. Finally, at midnight, Eisner reminded the directors that he had to give a major speech the next day. He joined Xenia Mucha to practice and then went to his room. But at 1 a.m., he got a call asking him to return to the directors' meeting. Nothing had been resolved, but Mitchell had agreed to consider becoming chairman overnight. In the meantime, they wanted to make sure that Eisner wasn't feeling hurt or rejected. Finally, at nearly 2 a.m., the directors dispersed. The next morning, thousands of shareholders and an enormous press corps have converged on the Philadelphia Convention Center, adjacent to the Marriott Hotel in downtown Philadelphia. Costumed Disney characters drift through the vast lobby as "Whistle While You Work" is piped through loudspeakers. Outside, hundreds of protesters have lined up, carrying signs denouncing Comcast, sweatshops, and the outsourcing of jobs to Asia. The vast meeting room is packed by 10 a.m. when proceedings begin. There's electricity in the air, a palpable sense.